Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. Developments in the coronavirus pandemic. President Biden is touting his signature $1.9 trillion COVID relief package as he prepares to travel around the country, selling to Americans the new law. The president declaring, and I'm quoting him now, "Help is here," soon after laying out an optimistic new timeline for trying to return to normal. But he cautioned that delivering on the promises in the relief plan will, quote, "require fastidious oversight to make sure there's no waste or fraud." Meanwhile, the CDC now says the U.S. has just reached an extraordinary milestone, more than 100 million administered doses of the COVID vaccines. And this just coming into the Situation Room right now, another major development, new calls for the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign. Both New York Democratic senators, the majority leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, they have just issued a joint statement saying Cuomo should step down after multiple allegations of sexual harassment. Let's begin our coverage this hour over at the White House. CNN's Jeff Zeleny is joining us. Jeff, the president, earlier today, he was cautiously optimistic during his address over in the White House Rose Garden. What else can you tell us?
Well, cautiously optimistic, but optimistic indeed, particularly given the last year that America has endured. Now, President Biden said he believes this $1.9 trillion bill is historic and transformational for millions of American families. Now, he said the first signs of these stimulus checks will begin arriving in the bank accounts of Americans this weekend, even as he says he still has some work to do to sell this bill to the rest of the country.
Help is here, and we will not stop working for you.
President Biden celebrating his first legislative success tonight, hailing the American Rescue Plan as a triumph to lift the nation from crisis.
Together with you, we are showing it's possible to get big, important things done. That's what America does.
It was a Rose Garden victory lap, with Biden soaking in his first official event there as president to tout a law now part of his legacy.
It changes the paradigm. For the first time in a long time, this bill puts working people in this nation first. It's not hyperbole, it's a fact.
But he made clear the jubilation over the $1.9 trillion law that will touch the lives of millions of Americans who've endured economic pain and hardship from the coronavirus pandemic came with deep responsibility for his new administration.
We have to get this right. Details matter because we have to continue to build confidence in the American people that their government can function for them and deliver.
Vice President Kamala Harris praised Biden's commitment to seeing the historic bill become reality, noting its focus on helping America's poor and middle class.
Help has arrived, America. This landmark legislation will get relief to families, get support to communities, and make sure more shots get in arms.
The president's often repeated campaign mantra,
"Help is on the way,"
will now be put to the test as the first stimulus checks start arriving in Americans' bank accounts as soon as this weekend. For the White House, it's something of an audacious gamble, effectively circling dates on the calendar when normalcy may start returning, a year after the pandemic changed everything. March 21st, 100 million shots in arms since taking office. May 1st, all adults eligible for the vaccine. And by July 4th, Americans can safely celebrate in small gatherings like backyard cookouts. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki trying to set expectations for that optimism.
We're not talking about a July 4th celebration on the mall. We're not quite there yet. This is a step more toward the kind of socialization and engagement with friends and family that he knows as a human being people have been missing over the last year.
The White House is launching an extensive sales pitch next week, with the President and First Lady, Vice President, and members of the Cabinet, traveling to points across the country to explain how the law can help Americans.
We're going to be traveling the country to speak directly to the American people about how this law is going to make a real difference in their lives.
The campaign is the first step in the administration's efforts to try and make permanent some provisions of the law, particularly aid to working families and others left behind.
This law is not the end of our efforts, though. I view it as only beginning.
Now, this $1.9 trillion spending bill, which really is, sprawling, affecting so many parts of the government, it is expected to touch 85% of American families. Now, President Biden says his administration is going to appoint someone to oversee the implementation of all of this to make sure the money is spent properly. He said the devil, of course, is in the details of this implementation. But Wolf, there is no question. This historic legislative achievement for President Biden sets his term off on the course of a positive direction. Now the question is, though, can any bipartisan bill ever be passed again? This, of course, was Democrats only. You saw Democrats in the White House, so the Rose Garden this afternoon. Of course, no Republicans, Wolf.
Yeah, no Republicans in the House or the Senate voted for this bill. Jeff Zeleny, thank you very much. Let's get some details now on a major new development in the fight against the coronavirus. More than 100 million doses of the COVID vaccines have now been administered here in the United States. That, according to fresh data just released by the CDC. CNN's Amara Walker is tracking the story for us. She's in Miami Beach for us. Amara, this is a big step toward crushing the pandemic.
Take off your mask.
After one long year, grandparents finally able to hug their children and grandchildren.
My daughter and granddaughter came to my apartment to give me a little gift, they said. And the gift was the prescription from the doctor. And it said, you are allowed to hug your granddaughter.
More reunions like these are on the horizon, with greater numbers of people getting vaccinated, with the record 2.9 million vaccinations reported since yesterday. Planning underway to implement President Biden's call for all adults to be eligible for vaccinations by May 1st.
Again, it doesn't mean that May 1st everyone's going to be able to get the shot in their arm, but on May 1st you should be able to get a date at which you'll have a shot in your arm if you haven't had one already.
That shot may come too late for some. A new forecast by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation estimates the death toll from COVID-19 will near 600,000 by July 1st, with fewer people masking up. Beginning today, Maryland is reopening businesses, including restaurants, gyms, and places of worship at full capacity, though a mask mandate and social distancing requirements will remain in place. New Orleans also allowing some businesses, including restaurants, to increase to 75% capacity with masking and social distancing still required. It seems like these in Florida that experts worry will hurt progress. Maskless spring break revelers gathering in crowds. Officials in Miami Beach tell CNN they expect the highest number of tourists since the pandemic began this weekend and next.
Everybody keeps saying COVID doesn't exist down here in Florida, so.
And I think we're going to get fooled. You're going to see that as we enter the summer months, numbers are going to go down and people are going to think, great, we're good. They're going to be less interested in getting a vaccine because they think that we've conquered this pandemic.
Concerns over spring break travel prompting the superintendent of Atlanta Public Schools to move the district to virtual learning for 1 week after students return. The TSA reporting a spike in air travel. The TSA screened 1.28 million people on Thursday, making it the third busiest day at American airports since the pandemic started.
We must remain vigilant.
The CDC, however, is cautioning against travel, even for the vaccinated, saying it would consider revising its guidance once more people get their shots.
We are very worried about transmissible variants. A lot of them have come through our travel corridors. So we're being extra cautious right now with travel.
And there has been some pushback, Wolf, against the CDC's no travel guidance for the fully vaccinated. In fact, our CNN medical analyst, Dr. Lena Nguyen, says that she believes it is safe for the fully vaccinated to travel and that that could actually serve as an incentive for people to get shots in their arms.
Key words, fully vaccinated. Amara Walker in Miami Beach for us. Amara, thanks for that report. Let's get some analysis right now from the Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, Dr. Ashish Jha. Dr. Jha, thanks so much for joining us. First of all, how significant is this milestone? More than 100 million total doses of the coronavirus vaccines have now been administered here in the U.S. since December.
So, hi, well, thanks for having me on. It's wonderful, right? It's and it's happened much quicker than I think many of us had expected. It's terrific. And we got to keep going. There are many more Americans who still want shots, and we've got more vaccines coming. So I think we should celebrate, but at the same time, focus on ramping up vaccinations even more.
I think that's strong advice. So the president now says all American adults will be eligible to get the coronavirus vaccine, everyone 18 and older, by May 1st. Will removing these eligibility guidelines that all of us have been going through these past several months, will it help states get vaccines into arms more quickly?
I think they will. I mean, I think this that May 1st deadline or that sort of benchmark is right. Look, right now we got to get high-risk people vaccinated, people over 55, people with chronic comorbidities. That can happen between now and the end of April. And then after that, once we get into May, let's open it up for every adult. And I suspect that any adult who wants one should be able to get one sometime during the month of May and then finish up their full vaccination, certainly by June.
I think that would be great if that happens. Standby, Dr. Jha. I want to bring in our senior political correspondent, Abby Phillip, and CNN senior commentator, John Kasich. Abby, President Biden just held this event over the Rose Garden at the White House before embarking on an effort to sell the legislation in the coming days. He's going to be doing some traveling. How important is it that he has the support right now of the American people in implementing this huge effort?
I think it's extraordinarily important. They took a big risk politically in doing this without any Republican support, doing it quickly and with a legislative process that most people probably don't care about. But Republicans are going to argue, cut out the possibility of bipartisanship. But they did that because they believe that the upside of it, which is a bill that basically touches the vast majority of Americans and gives them cash in their pockets, is going to be worth it. But Americans are only going to feel that benefit if they're only going to believe that they've benefited, I think, if they are reminded about it, reminded about the provisions that they're eligible for. And Joe Biden knows this very well, not just because of the Recovery Act that he was a part of in the Obama administration, but also because of what happened with the health care bill, the Affordable Care Act. Both of those are things that he believes were not sold properly and ended up being part of a Republican argument against the Obama administration in the midterm elections and in the 2012 elections. They don't want to repeat that mistake.
Yeah, that's important. You know, Governor Kasich, none of your fellow Republicans supported this bill, either in the House or the Senate, for that matter. It's very popular, though, with Americans across the political spectrum, if you take a look at the public opinion polls. Do you think it's realistic to think Republicans will support anything that the president tries to do going forward?
Well, I think, first of all, Wolf, as I told you, I thought the package was a little too big, but I think it should pass. And I tell you, I watched Joe Biden speak last night. I watched his speech in full this afternoon. He did a terrific job, kind of the guy that got me excited and why I supported him. Now, think about how great it is for him to be able to travel all around and say to people, look, help is coming your way. In fact, some of the help you've already received. I mean, it's pitch perfect, and you're going to see the people respond in many different ways, and they respond positively, and I think you'll see his numbers go up. I mean, the problem we have in politics today is if your side's for it, I'm not for it. I'm not going to give you any praise. I think that's a terrible mistake for the country. But again, as I've said repeatedly and will continue to, we live in an I culture now about what's in it for me, not a we culture. And the quicker we can get to we, where we're all in this together and helping one another, that would be great. Now, going forward, Wolf, the one thing I want to be clear about is at some point you got to start paying for this stuff, because we just this is a little different. This is a pandemic. But as we move forward, there's got to be a way to figure out how to pay for this package, because, you know, you and I and your wife, my wife, we can't be having a party and then tell the kids that they're going to have to pay for it, because, you know, the national debt is a real deal. You can't repeal gravity or the impact on massive federal spending that is not supported with spending reform. So, Wolf, what I would say to you is what's going to happen? I mean, if they take pieces, if you can get the immigration with the Dreamers, maybe that can happen. We just got to see. I will tell you this. Both parties love to cut ribbons when it comes to highway construction. So you may get some cooperation there, but we just got to watch our spending before we wreck the economy for our children and grandchildren.
Well, on that note, Abby, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, seems to be leaning toward pursuing infrastructure spending as the next big legislative item, including highway construction, everything else. Other Democrats, though, are suggesting they want to deal with voting rights, gun control, comprehensive immigration reform. Where do you think President Biden will focus his next effort?
Well, I think we know Joe Biden is a big fan of American infrastructure, particularly our train infrastructure. And I think that that actually is where his heart is. Democrats have for a long, long time wanted to do a major infrastructure bill as a means of spurring economic growth, actually as a vehicle also of putting into place some green job reforms that they think need to be supported by the federal government across the country. But what I think might actually make this the next thing that really does happen is that this is potentially a vehicle where bipartisanship could happen. Republicans also, some of them, want to do infrastructure as well. And then when you look at the private sector, you see groups like the manufacturing groups and business groups also wanting to push both parties towards an immigration bill. For Joe Biden, this may be the way to do it. All of those other priorities are critical for Democrats, particularly progressive, but they are almost certain to not get any bipartisan support. And I do think that still remains something that is important to this White House.
All right, everybody stand by. There's more news we're following. But first, an important note to our viewers. Be sure to tune in 8 a.m. Eastern every Sunday morning for Inside Politics Sunday with Abby Phillip. There you see it. Abby's going to be hosting, anchoring Inside Politics Sunday, this Sunday, every Sunday. We'll be watching, Abby, for sure. Just ahead, New York's two Democratic senators now say Governor Andrew Cuomo should resign. But the governor is defiant. He's denying any sexual misconduct. And later, we'll have details on a major settlement just reached by the city of Minneapolis with the family of George Floyd. President Biden is touting the first major legislative achievement of his new administration, a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, as he cautiously lays out a new timeline for the country trying to return to normal. Let's talk about that and more with the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Adam Schiff. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us. As you know, the president held this celebration in the White House Rose Garden today for passage of this enormous relief bill. He'll now start to promote it around the country in a tour that starts in the coming days. What do you say to Republicans who argue he's taking a victory lap, claiming credit for the foundation that they say was laid by the Trump administration?
Well, I don't know how they're going to give Donald Trump credit for a bill that they opposed that President Biden and Democrats in Congress worked to achieve and to get help to American families that really need it right now. I don't doubt that they're unhappy. The president is going to go out on the road and tell Americans what's in this bill and what's in it for them, because it's going to make it harder for them to defend their votes against help for small businesses, help for schools to reopen, help for vaccine rollout. I wouldn't want to be defending their position either. But Wolf, I think that Joe Biden recognizes a mistake that was that occurred during the Obama administration, and that is they didn't get out and sell the American Recovery Act. They didn't get out and sell the Affordable Care Act the way they should have. Now, those things became more popular over time, but I think Joe Biden is determined not to make that mistake again.
And they got to do this distribution of these billions and billions of dollars in a way that will avoid a lot of the fraud and abuse that occurred in earlier administrations. As you well know, Congressman, that's not an easy matter.
No, it isn't. But Wolf, you're absolutely right. You know, there's been massive fraud in the unemployment system with the loss of billions and billions of dollars. We don't have money like that to waste. We don't have any money to waste. And, you know, that happened under the prior watch. But now Joe Biden is president of the United States, and he will have the responsibility along with the rest of us to make sure that that those funds are wisely spent, expeditiously spent, and not diverted or defrauded.
The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the next big ticket item on the agenda should be infrastructure. First of all, do you support that?
I do. I think it's probably the most fertile ground for bipartisan work. And our country certainly needs it. You and I and so many millions of Americans have had the experience of going to an airport in the United States, flying abroad, and landing in an airport that was far nicer than the one we left, traveled on roads that were far nicer than the roads back home. We have really fallen behind with the maintenance of our infrastructure. There's a lot of new infrastructure in terms of the renewable energy superhighway that we also need to build. So the country desperately needs it. It would create millions and millions of jobs. And both parties have traditionally supported it. So I'm hoping we can get to yes.
Maybe there will be some bipartisan cooperation. We shall see. While I have you, Congressman, on a very different note, I just want to get your thoughts, because the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, the other Democratic senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, they have now joined 14 of your Democratic House colleagues, all from New York State, in calling for the governor, Andrew Cuomo's, resignation. In light of these mounting sexual harassment allegations, what do you think? Is it time for him to step down?
I think that my colleagues from New York are right. It probably is time for him to step down. They're closer to the situation than I am. But, I have confidence that if they've made the judgment that he can't govern anymore, that he doesn't have their confidence or the confidence of New Yorkers to do that, and in light of the seriousness of the allegations of sexual assault or harassment, then I don't think he can carry on. And in the best interest of the people of New York, he should resign. So I think they've reached the right judgment, and they're in a position to know.
Yeah, the pressure clearly is mounting. Congressman Adam Schiff, thanks so much for joining us as usual.
Thank you, Wolf.
Just ahead, the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. As you heard, he's facing enormous pressure right now to resign after multiple allegations of sexual harassment. And once again, both New York Democratic senators now say he should step down. Also ahead, the royal tussle between Meghan Markle and British TV host Piers Morgan. That is escalating. It's reaching a new level. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is defiant tonight amid growing allegations of sexual misconduct and new calls to resign from both of New York's Democratic senators. The Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, the two Democrats, have now joined a majority of the New York Democratic congressional delegation in demanding that the governor step down. But Cuomo is still very defiant. Listen to this.
I never harassed anyone. I never abused anyone. I never assaulted anyone. And I never would, right? Now, is it possible that I have taken a picture with a person who, after the fact, says they were uncomfortable with the pose in the picture? Yes. And that's what you're hearing about. Politicians who don't know a single fact, but yet form a conclusion and an opinion, are, in my opinion, reckless and dangerous. The people of New York should not have confidence in a politician who takes a position without knowing any facts or substance.
Let's bring in our crime and justice correspondent, Shimon Prokopes. He's following the story. He's in Albany, the New York State Capitol, right now. Shimon, first of all, tell us about the newest allegations against Governor Cuomo.
Yeah, Wolf. So this comes from a woman who was a reporter here back in 2014 here in Albany. She was covering the governor. She was 25 years old at the time. She is now a reporter in Miami, and she wrote a first-person account in the New York Magazine today that was published. And what she writes is that at the time when she was covering the governor, she describes how he touched her inappropriately, and more specifically, what she writes is that he put his other arm around my back, his hand on my waist, and held me firmly in place and said, quote, "I'm sorry, Am I making you uncomfortable? I thought we were going steady, she says. That's what he said. And then she writes that I stood there in stunned silence, shocked and humiliated. But of course, that was the point. She also writes that Andrew Cuomo's hands had been on my body, on my arm, my shoulders, the small of my back, my waist, often enough. And then she says, Cuomo never let me forget I was a woman. And then she writes that this was not necessarily about him wanting to have sex with her. She says that she never thought that the governor wanted to have sex with her. It wasn't about sex. It was about power. Of course, she is one of several other women who have come forward to talk about this inappropriate behavior by the governor. Of course, all of this coming on the heels of the calls for the governor to resign, and now this account. And we'll see. The governor has denied any wrongdoing. Today he spoke out saying he's done nothing wrong, nothing inappropriate. And we'll see what these latest allegations bring, Wolf.
Yeah, the joint statement from the two senators concludes by saying it is clear that Governor Cuomo has lost the confidence of his governing partners and the people of New York. Governor Cuomo should resign. That statement from Kirsten Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer just coming in a little while ago. Schumer, stand by. I want to bring in CNN legal analyst Ann Milgram and Albany bureau chief for the New York Times, Jesse McKinley. And what's your reaction to this latest allegation, this one from Jessica Bakeman, the young reporter?
Well, Wolf, I think, you know, we're now at a point where we're counting the number of allegations. We need two hands to do so. And so that is significant. And while the investigations have to look at each individual allegation, It does speak volumes that we're now seeing yet another woman come forward and make these allegations. And so this is a really important point to make, that as the investigations go forward and as the sort of political process is playing out, there's a constant, it feels like, drumbeat of allegations coming against the governor. And he's making a statement saying he didn't do anything wrong. But again, that's not for him to decide. And at this point, I think it's really become a question of a significant volume of allegations that must be investigated.
You know, Jesse, Bakeman describes how the governor, in her words, humiliated her. She says, from her perspective, this was about power. How damaging are these latest accusations?
Well, I think the allegations in total is what you have to look at. At this point, we're, as your correspondent mentioned, we're on a two-hand basis at this point. And the governor's rebuttal of this today was basically like, we have to wait. We have to wait for the facts. We have to wait for the investigations. But I think there's impatience both in the halls of Albany as well as in the general public as for answers. You know, at this point, the investigations are working on two tracks, not only the legislature, but also Tish James, the attorney general. But the governor has yet to offer kind of concrete answers as to what happened in some of these instances. Other cases, he simply denied them. But I think that strategy may not be working for him at this moment.
You know, Ann, legally speaking, how much trouble do these allegations, all these allegations, actually present for the governor?
Well, there's three things happening now. As we just heard, there's a legislative impeachment inquiry committee hearings that are about to start. That would be a public investigation. There's the Tish James Attorney General investigation. Both of those would lead to reports that could lead to discipline, recommendations that the governor be impeached or resign. But then there's also the allegation that came out in the Times Union of Albany this week that was the governor's office has confirmed was referred to the police. And that was an allegation of a misdemeanor sexual assault. And so, again, there are a lot of pieces moving. And then there's just one other piece I would mention, which is I think that there will be real questions asked about how the administration and the senior leadership outside of the governor's office handled these incidents as they arose, if they are substantiated. And so there could be more people than just the governor who have to answer for what's happened here.
Yeah, just want to point out, CNN has not confirmed that allegation from that unnamed woman named in that Albany Times Union story. We don't know who she is. We have not been able to speak with her. As you know, Jesse, Governor Cuomo, he's now lost the support of both Democratic senators, Schumer and Gillibrand, in addition to almost most of the rest of the New York Democratic congressional delegations, a lot of local leaders, the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, wants him to resign. Do you think he can continue to refuse to resign as he loses all this enormous political support?
Well, I think the one place everyone should be looking tonight is the White House and whether President Biden would make any sort of statement calling on the governor to resign or back-channeling that to the governor and saying that perhaps it's time to go. Certainly, Schumer and Gillibrand saying that it's time to resign is not a good indication of the governor's political fate at this point. The word of the day was really defection. Most of the delegation in New York went against the governor today, following on the heels of Albany lawmakers who in mass have basically said the governor either needs to go or certainly needs to be investigated. So in terms of the trend line on this, it is not working in the governor's favor.
Yeah, these developments are moving very, very rapidly. Guys, thank you very much. There's more news we're following here in the Situation Room. A huge settlement just approved by Minneapolis for the family of George Floyd. Plus, a dramatic new move by Meghan Markle. Details of fresh fallout from her bombshell interview. The city of Minneapolis has just reached a major settlement with the family of George Floyd as jury selection continues for the trial of the ex-police officer accused of killing him. CNN's Omar Jimenez is joining us now from Minneapolis. He's got details. Omar, first of all, how is the family reacting?
Yeah, well, if they're pleased, but they want this to mean something and actually translate to police reform. The city reached this $27 million settlement in this wrongful death civil lawsuit. This is the second settlement in less than 5 years involving a Minneapolis police officer of at least $20 million. And George Floyd's brother knows that this isn't everything, but he does recognize that for the moment, this is a victory.
Everybody around this world who have marched with us on the front line or on the couch, it doesn't matter. Your heart was in a good place, and I like to thank everyone for that. Thank you all so much. May George live in power.
Now, of this money, $500,000 of it is going to the George Floyd makeshift memorial site that has seen some violence at points this week, but has also served as a central grieving point throughout all of this. The city council voted unanimously 13-0 to approve the settlement. On the same day, they voted 11-2 to advance a proposal to dismantle the police department here in Minneapolis in favor of a more encompassing public safety department. It now heads to a city charter commission. And for context, this is the second time the city has tried to do this. The first time it stalled at that city charter step. And it's important to note as well, the civil settlement reached here is separate from the ongoing criminal proceedings we're currently seeing against the former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, where we just wrapped the first week of jury selection, where now we have seven jurors, half of the 14 we need for trial, selected. Three of them are white men in their 20s to 30s. One is a white woman in her 50s, one a Hispanic man in his 20s, one a black man in his 30s, and the other a biracial woman in her 20s. As I mentioned, we are at the halfway point of the 14 jurors we need, including two alternates with court, and week two of three in jury selection now set to begin on Monday.
Omar Jimenez in Minneapolis. We'll stay in close touch with you, obviously. Thank you very much. Let's get some insight right now from CNN political commentator Bakari Sellers. Bakari, Ben Crump, the lead attorney for the Floyd family, says this massive settlement is, quote, one step on the journey to justice. Do you think that resonates with the millions of people who marched and protested in George Floyd's name last summer?
I think it resonates loudly because this is a singular step. This is a journey for justice. This is a collection thereof. And one of the biggest problems we have, Wolf, is that we've seen these settlements across the country. This isn't the first time that people have written checks after black blood has flowed through the streets. I mean, the fact is, during this trial, there has to be justice. And listening to the demographics of those jurors, where you have one mixed race individual and one black male, it gives me pause. It gives me hesitancy. I go into this relatively cynical, thinking that we're not going to get justice in this trial simply because we never do.
Former police officer Chauvin has now been charged, as you know, Bakari, with third-degree murder. How could this new development shape the prosecution's approach?
Well, I mean, first of all, just as a criminal defense lawyer, I see these cases often, and I represent individuals who face these charges often. And one thing that I can tell you is when there are a lot of charges out there, the prosecution has great leeway to figure out the intent behind many of these charges or behind the action. Many of the differences or the major difference between first degree, second degree, third degree is the level of intent that's involved. And so now the prosecution gets to go out there and say, look, you know, we want you to find this person guilty of first degree murder. That's why we're here. But a jury can go back in the room and come out with a smorgasbord of charges to find him guilty for. I think that anything less than first degree murder in a case like this is not full justice. But as a prosecutor would probably tell you that any guilty verdict they would take.
An attorney for the Floyd family, Bakari, told me that they're bracing for the possibility the Chauvin's defense team will try to smear George Floyd's character. Do you think that's a likely strategy in this particular trial?
Let me tell you one reason why I have a great deal of respect for you, Wolf, because the way you framed this case, I mean, you actually, unlike some, put the emphasis on the fact that this is the trial of Derek Chauvin. And when you walk on the street, when you hear people on TV, on the radio, refer to this thing as the George Floyd trial, it makes my skin crawl. It makes my stomach turn. I mean, imagine if we called it the Nicole Brown Simpson trial, for example. People would be livid. And so framing it as such, our language is so important in this matter because, yes, they're going to try to put George Floyd on trial. And George Floyd is not on trial. Like his brother said, may he find some peace and may he rest in power.
You know, it's so hard to convict a former police officer, as you well know, because you need a unanimous, you need all 12 jurors to agree. That is by no means an easy assignment for the prosecution.
It's the highest standard in the land. I mean, you know, when I'm giving closing arguments, I look at the jury and I say, it's not that you can't go back there and say, I believe, it's possible, it's probable, he may have. You have to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It literally is the highest standard in the land. And it's extremely difficult because police often go in there with the umbrella or the envelope of that blue shield. And there's a great deal of respect that goes along with that. And it's going to be very difficult for the prosecution to get a guilty verdict. But that's why we need more tools in the toolbox. And I think that if there was an opportunity to bring federal civil rights charges in a case like this, but we know the standard is really high, that would help. But this jury, this prosecution has their work cut out for them because I, like many, don't think that Derek Chauvin is going to be found guilty. But I hope I'm here in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month and I'm proven wrong.
Trial could go on for several weeks. Bakari, we will stay in close touch with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Wolf.
Also tonight, prosecutors say the January 6th Capitol siege here in Washington, the investigation is quickly becoming one of the largest criminal probes in American history as the Justice Department now prepares for more than 400 defendants and imminent guilty pleas, we're told. CNN's Brian Todd is working the story for us. So, Brian, so what's the latest in court today, first of all?
Wolf, just a short time ago, a federal judge ordered the release of a top member of the far right-wing militia group, the Oath Keepers, a man named Thomas Caldwell. This judge ordered Caldwell's release because of concerns about Caldwell's health. Even the prosecutors had argued that Caldwell is dangerous if he is released pending his trial. The judge also, though, questioned the evidence against Caldwell. He's charged with one of the more serious charges of conspiracy in this case. Meanwhile, we do have new information tonight on pressure that could be building on Trump confidant Roger Stone, because of alleged connections that Stone may have with members of the Oath Keepers who were bodyguards for him on January 6th and just before.
Ready?
Roger Stone, a close ally of former President Trump's, on the morning of January 6th, outside the Willard Hotel, not far from the White House.
How is this lady's picture?
As Stone stopped and took pictures with people, he was flanked by men who appeared to be bodyguards wearing tactical gear. CNN has previously identified some of them as members of the far-right anti-government militant group, the Oath Keepers. Tonight, two alleged members of the Oath Keepers, who prosecutors say worked security for Stone and provided other services, face federal charges in connection with the Capitol attack. One of them, Roberto Menuda, who prosecutors say was among the rioters who stormed the Capitol. Menuda was captured in this video screaming at police.
And you, and you, and you, and you, and you.
Another alleged oath keeper, Joshua James, was a driver for Stone as part of his security detail the day before the insurrection, according to the testimony of an FBI agent. James is also charged in connection with the Capitol siege. One former federal prosecutor believes that with the charges against those who guarded him on those days, federal investigators could be building a case against Roger Stone.
Here you have the Justice Department looking for why these far-right militia groups came on January 6th with pre-coordination, prepared for violence. And so I think if you want to connect them to the campaign, the Trump campaign, or the White House, one of the people you would be looking to do that through for sure would be Roger Stone.
Stone did speak at a rally in Washington the night before the January 6th riot, claiming the election was stolen from Trump, exhorting the crowd.
I will be with you tomorrow, shoulder to shoulder.
Stone was convicted in 2019 of witness tampering, obstruction of a congressional investigation, and other charges in connection with Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, but he was later pardoned by Donald Trump. He adamantly denies any involvement in the Capitol attack, denies any advance knowledge of it, any connection to any planning, says he was not at the Capitol that day. He was asked a couple of weeks ago by CNN about his connection to the Oath Keepers.
Guilt by association and innuendo. Disgusting. No real journalist would ever ask that question.
Since then, Stone has acknowledged that the Oath Keepers provided security for him on January 5th in Washington, but he denies knowing Roberto Menuda. Analysts say under so much legal pressure, the Oath Keepers charged could turn on each other or on Roger Stone.
It seems like these are people who really enjoyed wearing these uniforms, enjoyed playing and performing this role. But I think it's going to be another thing when they face the combined strength of the U.S. government.
Roger Stone's attorney would not comment for our story today, but Stone has said he had no knowledge of any role that those men guarding him allegedly played in storming the Capitol that day. Those men expected to plead not guilty. Wolf.
All right, Brian, thank you. Brian Todd reporting. Just ahead, new fallout from Meghan Markle's bombshell interview with Oprah. Yet there's more new fallout tonight from the explosive interview the Duke and Duchess of Sussex gave to Oprah Winfrey. Let's go to our royal correspondent, Max Foster. He's joining us right now. He's in the UK. So, Max, first of all, tell us what you're learning.
Well, what's interesting, earlier in the week, obviously, Wolf, I came on the show. We talked about how the Duchess of Sussex made a complaint to ITV over the anchor there, the morning anchor, Piers Morgan. He had gone on a tirade on Monday after the broadcast of this interview with Oprah Winfrey, saying he didn't believe a word of what the Duchess said, and that included in relation to mental health and in relation to the racism that she experienced. She talked about that experience famously. Now, she made a complaint to ITV. There were also 40,000 plus complaints to the broadcast regulator in this country from viewers, and that launched an investigation. We've now heard that the Duchess of Sussex has also made a complaint to Ofcom, which actually raises the seriousness of that complaint by another level, really, because the person that was involved in the complaint has also made a complaint, if that makes sense. So the investigation becomes a lot more serious into Piers Morgan's tirade, really, which has become a huge topic of debate here in the United Kingdom, has been very divisive. People with Piers, people against Piers. We've also heard tonight that the couple's foundation, it's called Archwell, has doubled down really on a lot of the issues that came out of the interview. So they've announced they are providing support and aligning with a number of new charities, and they promote diversity in the media, mental health awareness, but also racial injustice. So we're watching the couple, rather than stepping back after this interview, really increasing their support for a lot of the issues and conversations that came out of it.
And no reaction, no more reaction, I should say, from the royal family. Is that right?
No reaction from the royal family. The Queen has asked everyone to be quiet. They haven't been out on engagement, so they haven't been thrown questions. But there's a lot of frustration in the palace that they haven't been able to speak out, frankly. So we may hear next week.
All right, we'll still continue to follow this story. Thanks very much, Max Foster, reporting from the UK for us. To our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. Aaron Burnett out front starts right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level.
And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.